Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the OnFit Podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. I'm Emma McGarthy, Head of Sustainable Policy Analysis at OnFit, and today I'm joined by David McNeil, who is Director and Head of Climate Risk at Fitch Ratings, to discuss carbon offset markets. So welcome, David, and thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Emma. Great to be here.
Great. So let's dive in with my first question, which is, how can carbon offset markets support climate action on a large scale? And what is Fitch Ratings doing in this space?
Yeah, so I think in the context of the COP26 and some negotiations that are ongoing at the moment, we certainly heard a huge amount about climate finance, particularly access to finance for emerging markets. For a number of years, there's been the target of $100 billion of overseas development assistance from developed to emerging markets to help meet the costs of climate change mitigation and adaptation. So that's the public finance dimension. I think there's a recognition increasingly that, you know, the private sector will have to amplify that many times over to really kind of provide many of these emerging markets, many of these industries with access to capital to help them transition, to help them adapt to some of the physical climate risks that are inevitable. So the climate finance gap between needs and actual flows of finance is very large, and it is widening as some of the effects of climate change take hold. So capital market flows to emerging markets will be key to hitting the Paris Agreement targets. So the Task Force on Scaling Voluntary Carbon Markets actually estimates around $300 billion of annual financing will be needed by 2030 to align with the Paris Agreement. And around a third of that target will come from nature-based offsets, so forestry and land use projects. Within the private sector, we actually have seen fairly blistering growth of carbon offsets in the past 2 years. So, for example, RED credits, which are forestry-based emissions credits on reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, they've actually grown by nearly 300% in the past year in terms of issuance. So increasingly, there is interest in forestry and land use-based carbon offsets. There is a clamor for those types of projects, particularly amongst, you know, high emission sectors such as oil and gas, such as utilities, that are looking to lower their emissions footprint, particularly in their supply chain. So that's 2030. Actually, looking at 2050, some work done by University College London has actually highlighted that under a 1.5 degree Paris Agreement scenario, so full attainment of the Paris Agreement, we'd actually have to see a 100-fold increase in the size of the market from 2020 to 2050. So in terms of what Fitch is doing, we're taking a few approaches here. So we're tracking the development of the market, including looking at emerging regulatory risks for sectors with historically high dependence on offsets to meet their emissions reduction targets. So I'm thinking here particularly of aviation, where a number of airlines have had carbon neutrality or carbon neutral pledges for a number of years. And the bulk of that is through purchase of offset credits, typically low cost, low quality offsets. So the question then becomes, is this staving off some of the kind of wider CapEx and OpEx decisions that these industries need to be making to transition? Are they kind of, you know, essentially addicted to low cost, low quality offsets to meet these targets? So we are tracking the regulatory risk there within our credit ratings. Then beyond ratings, we're actually also looking at the climate and ESG profile of issuers and the credibility of their net zero and transition plans in the context of our ESG ratings. So these are ratings kind of looking at the overall ESG profile of issuers and the credibility of their short, medium and long-term plans for alignment with the Paris Agreement. And you can see the score of individual issuers there, and carbon offsets would be a kind of key aspect of that that we would look at within the profile.
Thanks, David. So in terms of these issuers that are obviously kind of not rating so well in terms of the kind of climate mitigation, what will you do with those issuers? Does it mean that you won't work with them, or are you then helping them to transition in a kind of better way?
Well, we are basically objective in our opinions. So we are providing kind of an assessment of the potential credit risks that could arise from tightening climate regulations. We've typically seen, you know, a pattern in many industries where, you know, voluntary carbon markets are then replaced with regulation in many places. So One example of that is shipping, where in the European Union, we are seeing shipping kind of being brought into the emissions trading scheme. Whereas in the past, that kind of sat outside of regulatory compliance systems, and it was largely based on voluntary and industry initiatives. And again, very heavy use of offsets. So what we're trying to do is to provide information to investors in particular on the credibility of transition plans, the potential kind of long-term risks that could arise from tightening regulation or reputational risks in some cases, and then kind of looking at the overall ESG profile of issuers within our ESG ratings. So that is separate from the credit assessment. That is purely kind of looking at the ESG credentials of issuers.
Thank you. So how is the market being priced and scaled, and what tools are required to enable this development? And obviously you mentioned that sometimes it starts off as voluntary, goes into risk, it becomes more regulatory. Should it be voluntary, or do you think there should be kind of a regulatory framework around this?
Yeah, so for most of, you know, the last few decades, we've seen voluntary standards dominate. So there is a patchwork of different standards, typically with kind of strong regional characteristics. So VCS, the gold standard, or the China Certified Emissions Reduction Credits. Each of these are quite dominant within regional markets, and they are kind of recognized as third-party assured standards in many cases. But generally, the pattern that we've seen historically with carbon offsets has been oversupply and low prices and low quality, as I mentioned. So some of these standards that I mentioned are being used within regulatory emissions trading schemes, such as California Cap and Trade. Similarly, China's emissions trading scheme, the national scheme that just launched, also has a role for emissions reduction credits. But the vast majority of trade is in the voluntary market. So, you know, I mentioned that kind of, you know, low cost, low quality picture that we see. We are actually starting to see rising competition at the top end of the market for high quality nature-based offsets in particular. And many of these credits are able to command much higher prices. So, for example, fair trade forestry offset credits typically trade around the $17 per ton mark of carbon. And that compares to an average of around $7 per ton globally for carbon offsets. So in terms of development of the market, I think, you know, with some of these kind of voluntary initiatives, such as the Task Force on Scaling Voluntary Carbon Markets, you know, these are being industry led, but they are working towards coalescing on common standards and standardization of the market. At the same time, I think there's increasing interest by market infrastructure providers in helping to kind of develop this market and develop regional trading hubs in particular. So Singapore, Hong Kong, and London are three areas in particular that are working actively to establish themselves as regional credit trading hubs. And this is building on local expertise in forex and commodities trading. So that's a kind of foundation for a lot of this infrastructure that's being built. I mentioned the high cost, high quality credits. One aspect of that that's quite interesting is in contrast to the picture that we've seen of low-cost credits, where that really limits the type of projects that can be financed, typically we've seen offsets in the past be dominated by renewable energy projects. So a lot of the credits are going to finance renewable energy, typically in emerging markets. As prices rise, this actually opens up the opportunity for a wider range of emissions reduction projects to be financed. So this could include, for example, industrial decarbonization in emerging markets, you know, thinking of high need markets such as India and China. It could finance retrofit of buildings and building energy efficiency improvements. And then it can also go towards forestry and land use. So emission reductions from land use changes or from afforestation that also can yield socioeconomic and biodiversity benefits. And I think there's a key interest there. So I mentioned that, the growth of carbon neutrality and net zero targets has been a major driver in the overall growth of the market in the last couple of years. So we've actually looked amongst Fitch rated issuers in developed markets. A substantial majority of issuers have public GHG emissions reduction targets. So utilities are actually the most engaged on public commitments, followed by companies in the food, beverage and tobacco sectors, and then oil and gas. What's interesting is nearly half of those net zero commitments have a target year between 2040 and 2050. And most corporates are unclear on whether they're going to rely on offsetting to achieve these goals, with only 8% ruling out the use of offsets. So there's a tendency in particular to kind of kick the can down the road and really put a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of emissions reductions out to 2040 and 2050. And in practice, a lot of these companies are relying very heavily on offsets at present, when really there's actually a lot of low-hanging fruit within these industries in terms of emissions reductions they can make within their operations, within their supply chains. So it's worrying, you know, that given the kind of scale of reductions that are needed and given, you know, where we are today, that a lot of these industries are still very dependent on offsets to deliver. So this analysis that we've done of developed market issuers, it found that only a fifth of targets by governments and by companies meet the basic criteria for credible net zero targets set out in the UN-backed Race to Zero campaign. So this includes providing details on interim targets and measures. So not just looking at 2040 or 2050 end goals, but looking at, for example, 2030 meaningful kind of interim targets and measures and publishing regular progress updates. So this is where a lot of companies are falling short in their carbon neutrality pledges and increasingly reliant on offsets.
Great, thank you. I mean, so yeah, obviously you've noted that the net zero kind of targets are driving this carbon offset market development. And we touched slightly upon the role the private sector can take and regulatory practice. So what policies do you think should be in place to further develop the carbon offset market, and how can private and public stakeholders collaborate to further develop it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a critical role for public policy here in addition to some of the kind of industry-led voluntary initiatives for standardization. I think there's a recognition that, you know, emissions trading is happening. Even if there aren't, you know, kind of established kind of global rules on this. What's interesting at the moment in the context of COP26 is the ongoing discussions on what's called Article 6 of the Paris Rulebook. So obviously in 2015, the Paris Agreement commitments were signed. In 2018, the majority of the implementation of the Paris Agreement was established, but the one area that was outstanding was the rules on international trade and emissions reduction credits and operation of carbon markets. There's actually a lot of very opposing interests between countries there. Many developed market issuers, countries are kind of looking to essentially kind of channel capital to emerging markets and to forestry and negative emissions projects. But then many emerging markets are actually kind of looking to both count the emissions reductions gained in the private sector. So from companies, say, a company in London purchasing an offset credit in Brazil, many of these countries are arguing these reductions should also count towards their national commitments under the Paris Agreement. So that's where there's been a bit of an impasse in the last couple of years, and subsequent meetings of the COP since 2015 have really not been able to resolve this. So we have seen some signs towards convergence of countries on this in the past week. It still seems relatively unlikely that there will be agreement on Article 6, but I think there's a recognition with this rapid growth that we've seen in the private sector carbon trading that really kind of establishing common rules would be galvanizing for the development of the industry. But it's also really a critical kind of part of the climate finance agenda as well. So facilitating that flow of private sector capital from many of these developed markets into emerging markets and helping these emerging markets to transition in a way that lowers their emissions profile. So I mentioned some of the challenges that we've seen in the past. Partly this is a fragmented market. So there's a lack of efficient linkages between buyers and sellers. And this is particularly an issue in the forestry sector, where there's very kind of strong interest from corporate buyers of emissions reduction credits in areas such as oil and gas to invest in forestry-based offsets. There's a lack of kind of large and scalable pools of projects that they can invest in. So this becomes quite a laborious process of kind of identifying projects to invest in and reaching out to partners on the ground. The Task Force on Scaling Voluntary Carbon Markets actually identified a few solutions to this. For example, structured finance and securitized products have been suggested as a solution to both increase liquidity and to help kind of develop the standardization and the scale of the market overall. In the absence of agreement on Article 6, we have actually seen many countries develop bilateral partnerships. So typically developed countries kind of signing agreements with emerging markets, Japan and Indonesia, for example, where overseas development assistance is going towards forestry and land use based negative emissions activities. Similarly, we've seen that in the last few weeks, Australia kind of declares intention to develop a high quality Indo-Pacific emissions trading market. And Australia has been particularly kind of active in the development of carbon offset credits in the past few years. In addition to that, I think going to the role of the public sector in addition to the private sector, I think there's increasing recognition of the role that blended finance, so public and private finance, can play, given the opportunities for emissions reduction lie in emerging markets. And I think overall, the kind of recognition of the opportunities around emissions trading are very strong. So the International Emissions Trading Association has actually estimated that efficient international carbon markets could actually cut the cost of delivering on the Paris Agreement by at least $250 billion a year by 2030. So lowering the cost, but also kind of increasing the ambition of many of these emissions reductions in emerging markets. And that would yield particular benefits for areas such as the Middle East, such as Sub-Saharan Africa, where offsets can play a key role.
Yeah, that's really fantastic to hear. So touching upon carbon credits, how do carbon credits fit in as a financial instrument into kind of global capital markets?
Yeah, so given this growth that we've seen in the past few years in both demand for carbon offsets and gradually the price of offsets, there's growing evidence of a price differential, as I mentioned, emerging for certified or high-quality offset credits, and particularly for nature or land use-based credits in comparison to those that are based on around renewable energy projects. Partly that stems from what we call concerns around the additionality of offsets. So this is the concern that a given emissions reduction project would have occurred in the absence of an offset credit. So renewable energy is one example of that, where the costs of solar and wind in so many countries have fallen so dramatically in the last 10 years that arguably many of these countries or many of these industries have incentives to move to renewable energy even in the absence of the credit. I think there's kind of minimum prices for fair trade certified credits, as I mentioned, of $17 per ton of CO2 for forest management credits and $10 per ton for renewable energy credits. So there is quite a kind of significant price differential, and forestry based credits are significantly higher than the prevailing prices for regular carbon credits. So what does this mean in terms of the capital markets? Well, we've seen asset managers actually moving in the past year to expand their voluntary carbon market exposure. So we've seen Manulife Financial Corporation, Gresham House, and JP Morgan Asset Management all launching or expanding businesses around forestry offsets and building internal resources and expertise in the growth of the market. So they really do identify this as a growth area for the next 10 years in particular. And this actually reflects the growth in general of speculative trading in regulatory and compliance carbon markets. So we have seen, for example, in the emissions trading compliance markets, very rapid growth in the price of these allowances over the past 2 years. The EU emissions trading scheme hit new highs of 60 euros per ton throughout this year. And this is starting to filter through gradually to the voluntary markets. And many companies, particularly those that are dependent on credits, are kind of looking at developing hedging strategies. So, for example, Shell and BP and many large power utilities have actually developed significant carbon trading arms in anticipation of rising costs of emissions trading scheme allowances, as well as voluntary credits. So they are holding on to many of these credits in anticipation of price increases in the future. And beyond being mere purchasers of credits, they are actively kind of engaging in the trade and transaction in these credits.
Great, thank you. So obviously we've touched a little bit on standards already, but I'm wondering what kind of standards for carbon credits are being established and how can we ensure that they are being traded in a robust and equitable manner and in robust and equitable markets?
Yeah, so the Task Force on Scaling Voluntary Carbon Markets actually was a set of core carbon principles for offsets to be compliant with. So to be CPP compliant, offset projects would need a clear, measurable, direct impact on reducing emissions. And accreditation would actually be administered via standard setters approved by a new governance body, which the Task Force on Scaling Voluntary Markets has actually announced in terms of members. So this actually consists of 22 industry participants, including BP, Standard Chartered, Conservation International, and the Climate Bonds Initiative. There has been some concern around the role of many buyers of offset credits in the governance body. So that was partly the kind of inspiration behind the Voluntary Carbon Markets Integrity Initiative, which has been supported both by the UK government and the Children's Investment Fund Foundation. So again, that is very focused around kind of establishing common rules for the market, common principles for offset credits, and really trying to be an objective provider of standards there. And I think this is interesting, you know, if you look at the historical growth of, say, the green bond market and the green social and sustainability bond market, a lot of that emerged from voluntary initiatives or industry-led initiatives with public and investor support. So, for example, the green bond principles, which have been maintained by ICMA for over 10 years, actually kind of went on to influence a lot of kind of regulatory actions, such as green bond standard in the European Union. So we actually kind of do see these in many cases as what we call pre-regulation. They're a template for voluntary standards that then subsequently shape regulatory thinking around standards and performance targets. So in addition to the kind of standardization push, which we are seeing, I think the other area to highlight is, you know, technology playing a key role in shadow reporting of carbon offset claims. So increasingly, a lot of the costs of technologies such as LiDAR, satellite monitoring and remote sensing, and technologies such as blockchain are falling. And this actually allows a wider range of industry participants, including NGOs and private companies, to use these technologies to actually verify claims that companies are making on the ground. So, for example, verifying forest carbon emissions reductions by monitoring the performance of those projects on the ground. So one example of this is you're measuring the baseline from which emissions reductions are calculated. So there's an NGO called Carbon Plan in the US. They actually found that California's offset projects were overclaiming around a third of the carbon savings. So that means around $400 million US dollars was paid for 30 million metric tons of emission reductions in that market that didn't actually occur. And as I mentioned, in California, offset credits can be included within the statewide cap and trade scheme. So I think increasingly there will be kind of scrutiny of many of these projects on the ground. The falling costs of technology and kind of shadow reporting will kind of open these up to more kind of regulatory scrutiny, more reputational scrutiny. And companies that are, you know, particularly dependent on low cost and low quality offset credits are potentially exposing themselves to longer term risks.
Great. So my final question is, what are the challenges surrounding the carbon offset market? And what do buyers or carbon credit need to consider? And to end on a slightly more positive note, what opportunities do you think there are over the next kind of 20 years or so as well?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I think, you know, the regulatory and reputational risks of ineffective offsets are becoming much clearer. There are kind of practical examples of this that are starting to crop up. For example, the Dutch media regulator demanded Shell remove references to its carbon offset projects on the basis of, you know, perceived weaknesses of these projects on the ground in Latin America. So there is increasingly kind of scrutiny of these claims and scrutiny of perceived greenwashing. I think that is kind of ongoing in the context of a wider kind of push towards kind of litigation in the climate space, and many companies being, you know, called out by regulators, by, you know, other kind of market participants on the claims that they're making with regards to climate and with regards to their net zero targets. So persistently low prices of offsets potentially expose these companies to regulatory risk if the use of offsets deters investment in low carbon technologies in research and development, and emissions reduction targets are missed as a result of weak offset outcomes. Similarly, I think ineffective offsets expose bias to reputational risks if the projects are linked to social and environmental controversies or weak climate mitigation outcomes. One of the kind of challenges here, particularly in the context of forestry offsets, is the lack of kind of long-term permanence of those emission reductions. So we have, for example, seen many offset projects that have been lost to wildfires, which is not, in this case, you know, the responsibility of the buyer of the offset credit, but it does mean that those net emissions continue to increase. So the permanence of carbon emissions that are kind of kept, or carbon that is kept in the ground in oil and gas wells, or versus carbon that is stored in forestry, is much less in practice. So BP, for example, has been pursuing forest carbon offsets for a decade. It's been contributing to the World Bank's Carbon Fund and Forest Carbon Partnership. But the latter has been subject to criticism from NGOs such as Fern and Rainforest Foundation UK for weak social and environmental outcomes. So many of these purchases of credits are being significantly more scrutinized in this. Kind of going to the second point of your question around, you know, opportunities, I think clearly there is massive opportunities for effective offsets to channel capital from developed markets to high-need emerging markets. We typically see a pattern where many of the projects on the ground that are particularly kind of beneficial in terms of emissions reductions, so high-quality emissions reduction projects, typically, they also have significant levels of socioeconomic benefit locally. So they are providing, for example, local employment. They're engaging local communities and the long-term responsible management of, for example, forestry and land use resources. So I think there are key opportunities there. And then I think, you know, the area that is quite often touched upon, but, you know, not kind of measured in a kind of a meaningful way is biodiversity and natural capital. So the potential of forestry and land use offsets to really kind of channel huge amounts of private sector capital towards nature conservation. And I think the task force on nature-related financial disclosures is really at the early stages of starting to look at nature-related financial risk and the role that particularly banks and large kind of asset owners can play in channeling capital away from activities that are negative in nature, or kind of lead to deforestation and biodiversity loss. So I think, you know, there's a real potential there for a lot of that capital to be channeled. I think there's a need, certainly in the biodiversity outcomes side of the equation, for much better data, so that we can measure these outcomes consistently and comparably. Clearly, you know, measuring outcomes in terms of carbon emissions is, although it's complicated, it's a much more simple proposition than measuring outcomes in terms of biodiversity. But I think, you know, we can see in the context of the Convention on Biological Diversity, the context of some of the kind of global UN biodiversity targets, which are kind of being worked on for 2030 at the moment, there is a real opportunity there to link kind of climate and nature conservation goals in a way that kind of both kind of yields additional climate finance for high-need emerging markets, but also channels conservation capital to many of these biodiverse emerging markets. And I think, you know, in the context of the deforestation commitment that was made at the COP last week, that actually reiterated pledges that were made in 2014. I think the major difference there was that there were actually 14 billion of public finance funds that were committed to that, in addition to private sector capital. I think there's a recognition that many of these biodiverse emerging markets are critically dependent on soft commodities for balance of payments and for their trade position. So kind of asking, you know, Brazil, Indonesia, Malaysia to kind of bear the brunt of kind of costs of addressing deforestation without assistance is not just not going to be valid. So again, that's where the private sector can play a key constructive role in channeling capital towards tackling deforestation, tackling nature loss and climate action at the same time.
Yeah, fantastic. I think this is such an amazing initiative and really great to hear how it is progressing and the opportunities that are out there, and certainly great to note the kind of biodiversity and nature loss elements of things, which is definitely something that the Sustainable Policy Institute will be focusing on in the coming months, and the TNFD and disclosure framework surrounding biodiversity. So really great that's becoming part of this initiative as well. And thank you so much, David. And thank you to everybody for listening. You can subscribe to this and all other OnFIF podcasts on our channel on Spotify and iTunes. David, thank you again for joining us today.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF podcast.